Chapter 11. Communion. Let us start with the truth and move on to more interesting matters. Attributed to Malkador the Sigillite. Two legions slowly marched side by side along the Avenue of Heroes towards the castrum and the fortress, like a half-black, half-blue river. On the right-hand side of the column marched the Ultramarines, on the left, the Dark Angels. Behind the main column came the remnants of the other legions, and then the army units and the Titan engines. Crowds cheered and waved from both sides of the vast route.
"The last time this many banners were carried aloft must have been on Ulanor," the Lion said.
"I think so," Gilliman agreed. They were walking side by side at the head of the procession, half shaded by the legion standards being carried at their heels. Holguin and Redloss escorted the Lion, and Gorod and his lieutenant Maglios flanked the Avenging Sun.
"It is a glorious feeling," the Lion said, "and one we deserve. Your warriors after the ordeal of Nuceria and the many battles of Lorgar's Shadow Crusade. Mine after Thramas and the Fury of the Warp."
"You will tell me, I hope, about the Thramas Crusade in detail," Gilliman said.
"I will. You fought against Conrad, against the 8th Legion. Traitors all, sad be the day. I have prisoners aboard the flagship, including his first captain, Sevatar."
Gilliman glanced sideways at his expressionless brother.
"Have you interrogated him? Have you rooted out the cause of this treason?"
"Have you?" asked the Lion. "In your wars against Angron and Lorgar, have you identified their argument?"
"It is the warp," replied Gilliman. "It is an infection, a pollution of the soul. On Nuceria, the horrors I saw heaped upon Angron by one he considered a comrade. Our brothers, even the Lupercal, have not turned against us. They have been turned."
"I think so too," the Lion replied. "It is a hard thought to hold. I cannot imagine having cause to turn against our father and Terra, but I can at least conceive of the possibility of a cogent argument for dissent. This treason, it spreads like a plague. It is contagious."
"It is, which is why I imagine you came to me."
The Lion glanced sideways at Gilliman.
"Rabute, such a question?"
"Your ships were not lost, brother. They were heading for Macragge when the storm struck. I have read the flight logs. Did you fear I'd turned with Horus and become a threat to our father? Have you come to sanction me like Russ's wolf pack?"
The Lion laughed.
"My dear Rabute, I did not think for a moment that you had turned. I thought you'd done much, much worse."
He looked at Gilliman.
"I think we both know you have."
He glanced at the castrum ahead, the towering bulk of the Fortress of Hera.
"That is quite a place," he said. "I am impressed. I expect a proper tour and inspection."
The memorial gardens lay to the east of the Avenue of Heroes. John Grammaticus watched the glittering column move by, banners aloft, heading up the titanic street to the Porta Hera, a cyclopean gateway in the castrum wall that he could see from 6 kilometres away. It was a display of force, John had to admit. The legions were good at that. They were good at killing, too. And the vanguard, the army and the Titan engines, a god-slaying force. John was especially impressed by the retinues of the so-called Shattered Legions. They suggested a human resolve that John knew the Cabal doubted. They stood together, despite their losses. They fought on. "We always have," he thought. "Watchers for just a moment, though a moment to you might be 10,000 years to us, and you'll see we are not children. We have morals and souls." The memorial gardens were far too civilized. Walls of inscribed stone flanked oblong pools of pale water lilies and beds of rushes and vein flowers. The Ultramarines dignified their dead. They engraved their names upon the flagstones of the Avenue of Heroes, and again here in the gardens, and also on the black marble walls of the Chapel of Memorial in the Great Fortress. It was the gardens where the dead were actually interred, in pre-built catacombs that lay beneath the beds and pools.
John had a vision of the day when, after endless centuries of war, there would be no room left on the flagstones of the avenue to fit more names, and the catacombs would be full and the walls of the chapel would be covered. Where would they commemorate all their dead then? He blinked back the thought. The funerary shuttles had been cleared to land on the raised stone decks of the garden compound. 8 of them, wings hinged up like butterflies, sat side by side on the landing terrace. Their cargoes of sarcophagi would be unloaded later. Because of the parade, there weren't enough Legion personnel available to conduct the rites and deliver the dead in respectful silence to their resting places. John was content enough, however. As Idris Cluett, an officer of repatriation, the funerary flights had got him to the surface of Macragge and deep inside the great civitas. The Ultramarines' solemn respect for their fallen had allowed him to circumvent almost all of Macragge's complex layers of planetary security. Most of the other crews from the repatriation flights had gone to the edge of the landing terrace to watch the procession pass along the avenue. A few were running systems checks on the landers, which were parked on the deck with their canopies up and their loading ramps down. Time to slip away. Time to step out of Idris Cluett and find a new person to hide in. John picked up his pack, slung it across his shoulder and walked quietly away through the lawns and bowers. The jet-black mourning uniform was sober and smart, and because it was austere and lacked any rank pins except the golden Ultima and Omega of the funeral watch, it suggested he was of a higher rank than he actually was. In a city of uniforms, he could pass for almost anyone and not be called on it, except by those with the most expert and detailed knowledge of Legion liveries. All eyes were on other grander things. Unchallenged and unobserved, he walked up the northern pathway of the gardens, passing under box hedge arches cut for transhuman statues, and along flagged walks shaded by stately yew and sorona trees. The planners had built the gardens to be appropriately noble and quietly sorrowful. The grey-leaved canopy turned even the day's bold light into a kind of dusk. The flagstones, the commemoration walls, and the entrances to the crypts were all of Saramanthian bluestone. The water lying in the long, oblong, black-reeded pools was as dark as veils. The silver shivers of ghost carp moved under the silent mirrors of the water. The lilies drifting on the surface of the pools were grey, like tear-stained handkerchiefs. Mirrors. A breeze hissed through the trees around him. John tensed. Ripples radiated across the surfaces of the pools. He was aware of the distant bombast of trumpets, war horns, and cheering in the distance, but it felt as though the volume had suddenly been turned down. John's eyeballs prickled. His mouth dried. A pulse began to tap in his temple. "Please don't do this now," he said, quietly but firmly. The cabal was trying to summon him. They were trying to establish a psychic communion, most likely using one of the pools nearby as a flecting surface. They were trying to keep track of him. They would want to be sure he was staying true to the task they had given him. He swallowed hard. The breeze hissed again, rustling grey leaves. The heavy object in his carry bag trembled slightly, as if sensitive to the immaterial stirrings around him. "Please." This time he spoke with his mind, not his mouth. "Please, I'm tired. I've only just got here and I'm at my wit's end. Let me get safe and rest. Come to me later when I can take the burden of a communion. Please." The breeze stirred. Who would it be? Gahet, he of the old kind, most probably, but John suspected the unsympathetic persistence of Slough Dar, the Eldar Autarch. "Please." He turned and resumed walking, but his skin was still prickling. The faraway sounds of the parade had become so muffled that John felt as though he was underwater. He glanced at the pool next to him involuntarily. The surface had frozen like dark glass, scrying glass. Below the surface, silvered fish had stilled, suspended, tail fins mid-stroke. A shadow fell across the flecting surface, and it wasn't his. He flinched as he saw the dark, rising crest of an Eldar war helm, the impossibly tall, attenuated figure, a scarecrow god, the dimensions of its slim, long-boned form running the whole length of the pool. "I said not now," John spat. He turned, tearing his eyes away from the shadow and striding down the flagstone path away from the pool. There was a buzzing in his hind brain. The leaves hissed. "Leave me alone," he growled over his shoulder. "Leave me alone." He left the gardens and entered the oddly quiet streets. Everyone in the Deem was lining the Avenue of Heroes. His head stung from the attempted communion, and his hands were shaking. They had to be careful. The Cabal had to be more careful than that. From his reviews in the guise of Tio Lasulk of Civitas Security, John knew that the 13th had reinstated their Librarius on a worldwide protocol. There was also a formidable contingent of the Astra Telepathica on the planet. Psychana techniques would be interlacing the defences. A raw conduit like the one Slaudar had attempted to forge in the gardens might well be detected. Detection by the Librarius would make his work very much more problematic and would probably end his life. This life, anyway. He was tired of dying. Shaking, he saw a fairly grand tavern on the corner of the next emptied street. Lights burned inside. It was an upscale place for senatorial officers and the political echelons of the Civitas. The whole neighbourhood adjoining the Memorial Gardens was elegant and well-to-do. He went inside. The place was a grand salon of gilded ormolu and chandeliers, with rows of tables under the high, frescoed ceiling and in booths along each wall. It was empty, aside from a few waiting staff and servitor units, and they saw to him quickly. John took a table in one of the booths, the nearest he could find, and sank back into its comparative privacy. The seats were high-backed and upholstered in leather, and the booth was formed from panels of coloured glass that rose from the tops of the seat backs to form partitions. At the back of the booth, the wall above the seats was a large crystal mirror in which John could watch the foot traffic coming in and out of the tavern without drawing attention to himself. His hands were still shaking. One of the aproned serving staff brought him a jug of water and a beaker and the large amasek he'd ordered as he'd walked in. "Will you dine, sir?" the servant asked. Food was an excellent idea. John had been poorly nourished the last few weeks as it was, and a decent hit of carbs and protein would help smooth out the after-sting of Slaudar's approach. "Bread," he said. "Salt butter. Something gamey or some chops." "We have a haunch of coil horn deer." "That will do. Some root vegetables." The servant nodded. "Are you not watching the parade, sir?" the servant asked. "Are you not?" John snapped. The man shrugged. "I'm working, sir," he said. John nodded and tried to warm up a smile. "Me too," he said. "Besides, when you've seen one space marine march past you, you've seen them all, haven't you?" The servant laughed as if this was a reasonably funny observation and went off to take the order to the kitchen. John poured a beaker of water. His damned hands were still trembling, but food would help take the edge off. So would the spirits. He raised the amasek. He needed to use two hands just to keep it steady. A sip. Warmth. Better. Better. He put the heavy glass down, felt the tension slip out of his wrists. There was a mark on the white tablecloth between his hands. A dot. A second dot appeared beside it. Spots of blood. His nose, his damn nose, was bleeding. He shook out his napkin and wiped his face. He hoped no one had seen. He could move the water jug to cover the blood spots. That damn Slaudar had done a real number on him. John took another sip of amasek, relishing the way that its burn counteracted his nerves, and checked the mirror at the back of the booth again, half expecting to see centurions of the Librarius bursting across the tavern threshold. Mirror? Oh, stupid. Oh, so stupid. His anxiety had made him clumsy. Mirrors and glass and reflective giltwork all around him. Hot wire pain jabbed in his head through the base of his skull. "No, no," he gasped. A little dribble of blood came out of his right nostril, ran down his mouth and chin and dappled the white linen. No hiding that. "Please." The mirror above the booth back frosted as though the room temperature had dropped 40 degrees. John refused to look at it, even though a force, a physical pull, was trying to tilt his face up by the chin to stare. "No, not now. Leave me alone." He forced himself to look down. He stared at his drink instead, the oily surface of the amasek, which was rippling because the hand clasping the heavy glass was trembling so hard. He looked at the constellation of dark blood spots on the tablecloth, marks that all the careful arrangement of beakers and jug could not hide. In the freshest of them, where the glossy blood had yet to soak into the linen, he saw reflections forming, a crested helm. John moaned. The amasek in his glass stopped rippling and froze. The glass frosted cold under his fingers. The crested helm reflection appeared in the amasek too. John groaned aloud and closed his eyes. "Slauda, you f—" he gasped. "Not Slauda." There was silence, no sound at all, except John's stumbling breath. The voice had not been that of the cruel Ortach, steel-sharp and cold-edged. It had been as dark and dense as ebony. John opened his eyes. The entire tavern had suspended. The candle flames, frozen, radiated a cool blue light, and that light sparkled off the chandeliers, the sconces, the ormolu, the mirrors, the stacked shelves of clean glasses for wine and amasek. Daylight, falling into the grand salon through the tavern's handsome windows, was stained blue, too, as if by very diluted ink. John could see serving staff across the room, poses locked mid-gesture, mouths open in mid-exchange. Silver shoals of ghost carp hung, stilled, in the blue air above the tables. The Eldar stood at his table. His lean frame in its form-fitting armour, combined with his crested helm and flowing robes, made him seem extravagantly tall and thin, like a gaunt spectre of death or a skeletal giant. "Not Slauda?" John murmured, surprised by the sound of his own voice. "You again." "Again," the Eldar replied from behind the beautifully terrifying visage of his helm. John's latest mission for the Cabal had begun on a world called Traoris. He was sent there to acquire a weapon, and then to use it to betray his species more than he had ever betrayed it before. John had struggled with his conscience for a long time, but this had brought him to the brink. The acquisition of the weapon that lay wrapped up in his carry bag had been miserable, and the prospect of what he was supposed to do with it more miserable still. The one ray of hope had been an intercession that had taken place during the Traoris mission, a Psychana communion visit from the very same Eldar who manifested before him. John had not been told the being's name, though he had suspicions, but he had been offered consolation, an alternative to following the Cabal's plans. Not all Eldar were of the same mind, it appeared. The Cabal wanted to sacrifice mankind to snuff the power of chaos out. This nameless Eldar lord opposed that thinking. He saw mankind not as a firebreak, but as a true ally against the rise of the archenemy. It seemed, and this notion troubled John more gravely than he cared to admit, that the Eldar were at war with themselves over what to do about the human civil war. "You promise me hope," John said. "I did." "On Traoris, you promised me hope, an alternative." "I did," the towering figure replied. "But there was nothing," John complained. "You offered to place information in my mind, information that would make me understand things in new ways. You offered me a conduit for the transfer of new thoughts." "I did." John sneered. There was only one thing true about it. You saw the conduit would hurt, and it did. I learned nothing else. No new perspectives, no alternative thinking. I don't know what you did to me, or why, but I was just being used again, wasn't I?
You learned a great deal, John Grammaticus. You just don't know you did yet.
John laughed. He laughed a dirty, mocking laugh and shook his head. He looked up at the impossible silver fish frozen mid-stroke in the blue air, and the servants locked in an eternal conversation. "You know what, nameless lord," he said. "I am sick to death of you Xenos breeds and your enigmatic little unmeanings. Say what you say plainly. Say something true, or get the hell out of my head." He snatched up the Amasek to take another sip, but the solid reflection of the Eldar still lay across the liquid, so he set it aside, untouched.
"Think, John Grammaticus," said the Eldar quietly. "Think, and you will recognize that you know much more than you knew you knew. Through the conduit I placed data and ideas in your head, but they were too dangerous to be left in your surface thoughts. All the while you were on Traoris, or making your way here, there were any number of chances you might be read by the notions of the warp, by your enemies, by the Dark Apostles, by your slave masters, the Cabal. They would each have killed you for thinking such thoughts, so I ensured they would not surface until the time was right."
"When will that be?"
"When you are come to Macragge in the realm of Ultramar."
"I'm here. I don't know anything different."
"Don't you? Think."
"Come on." The Eldar reached up and unclasped his war helm. He set its sculptural form on the linen cloth beside the spots of John's blood. His pale face, tinged blue in the psych light, was similarly sculptural, taut and high-boned. His long dark hair was bound up tight to fit beneath his helm, and there was a rune inscribed upon his forehead. There was nothing human about the intelligence in his dark eyes. Slowly, and with a dignity that seemed almost comical, he sat on the bench of the booth across from John. He was too tall and slender to fit the human space well. The long bones of his arms and legs just too long. Folding himself into the seat made him seem gangly, like an adolescent. Once seated, he spread his hands on the cloth, palms down. The fingers were as alarmingly long and slender as his limbs. Even sitting, he was taller than John.
"Think what you know," the Eldar said in his ebony voice. "Do you have the spear?"
"Yes," John answered, realizing he had shot an incriminating glance at the carry bag on the seat beside him. Not that the Eldar would have been under any illusion that the weapon was anywhere else.
"And you know what to do with it?"
"I know who I'm supposed to see killed with it, if that's what you mean."
"What else might you do?" asked the Eldar.
"I don't know," said John. "Sit here forever and talk riddles?"
"Who am I?" asked the Eldar.
"I don't know. You never said," John replied. "I have no way. You..." He hesitated, swallowed hard, wished the damn reflection wasn't in his drink so he could gulp it down.
"Eldrad Ulthran, Farseer of Ulthway Craftworld," he said in a very small voice.
"Indeed.
See then what you know."
"How did I know that?"
"The conduit put it in your head on Traoris so that you would know it now. It is one of many ideas the conduit put in your head."
"Is this the truth?" John asked.
"What else might it be?" Eldrad replied.
His spider-leg fingers gestured to the rune marks on his armor, his crested helm, and his brow.
"Are you a scholar of the path signs and world symbols of the Eldar lexicon? Do you recognize the marks of Ulthway?"
"No," said John.
"But you know them well enough now."
"What else do I know?" asked John. He thought for a second and then held up his hand to mute any response.
Wade, if we're dealing with truths, Farseer, tell me this. Why have you come to me? Why have you made such ridiculous efforts to commune with me? If you passed ideas into my mind months ago on Traoris, that would be secure until the very act of coming to Ultramar unpacked them, so I could know then. What the hell? What else have you got to tell me? This communion has placed us both in huge danger of being detected.
It is a risk worth taking when set against other risks, though I agree this conversation makes your position here more precarious by the second. The Ultramarines Librarius is already aware of a Psychana event. Fortunately, in 8 minutes' time, this communion will be eclipsed by another, more powerful Psychana event in the city, followed by a considerable crisis. Both will divert attention from you.
If we haven't got much time, speak fast. What do I need to know?
Almost everything you know already. Now you are here on Macrag, the ideas will unlock. The unpacking process, as you referred to it, may take a day or more, and ideas may come in strange orders, but do not be frustrated. It will give you all that you need.
Eldrad leaned forward.
I am here to warn you. That was my imperative. Since our communion on Traoris, I have foreseen new things, new dangers. It has been worth the effort forging this link just to make you aware of them.
What dangers? Asked John.
Two things, replied the Farseer. The Cabal may be beginning to suspect that your resolve is not all that it might be. They may make an effort to reinforce your commitment.
I've been expecting that, but thanks for the tip. What else?
It may be connected to the first thing. Someone is hunting you, John Grammaticus.
I see. Are they here, or...
They are here. Or will be soon.
Good to know. Eldrad nodded.
My departure is overdue, he said. Yours too, John Grammaticus. Use the fade of this communion to slip away. Do not stay. Find a safe place and unpack your mind. Choose your path. We are bound together, human, in the target of your mission and in the matter of Earth.
You said that before. You don't just mean earth as in soil, do you? You mean it literally, but not just literally. You're using the old meaning, too, aren't you? The old name for Terra?
There was no answer. Eldrad Ulthran was no longer there. John looked around. Time was still frozen. The silver fish still swam in the air. The servant's conversation was still paused. The light was still blue. But it would not remain so for long. John felt a prickle in his ears and a warmth in his spine. He could hear sounds returning as though from far away. 10, 15 seconds and the aura would be gone. He looked at the table, at his blood spots on the cloth. The reflections had vanished, at least. He picked up the Amasek, sank it in one gulp, then snatched up his carry bag and left the tavern just before the blue light fled and noisy reality resumed. A little under 8 minutes later, and just 9 streets away from the tavern in Ceres Deem, physical reality failed briefly and a mouth into the warp yawned open. Members of the Librarius of the 13th Legion, in concert with adepts of the Astra Telepathica, were monitoring the psychic landscape of the Civitas, and had already detected the Farseer's communion with John in the tavern, though they had not identified it. A rapid response squad of Librarius officers and cataphracti terminators had been sent to the tavern location in armoured landspeeders and heavy skimmers. The warp tear occurred in a scriptorium in the Via Edern, south of the Memorial Gardens and east of the Avenue of Heroes.
The moment it took place, psychic wards in the Red Basilica and the Sacristy of the Librarius pealed out their warnings. Two attuned adepts in the Basilica suffered debilitating strokes. The fast response force was immediately and urgently diverted to the Via Edirne. The scriptorium had been closed and locked for the afternoon so that the scribes and rubricators who worked there, repairing and transcribing old books, could attend the parade. In the gloomy, unlit chambers, lined with shelves of manuscripts, filled with lecterns and stinking of cochineal and mixing oils, papers began to rustle. Books and bound manuscripts on the shelves and desks began to shiver and rattle, or fell onto the floor, or spilled open as if a strong breeze were rifling their pages, or an invisible scholar was speed-reading them. Locked cases of more valuable books began to quiver, the chains and padlocks rattling as though the rebellious tomes wanted to break out and fly free, flapping their pages like wings. More than anything, it appeared as though the density of words held in that one place was what had drawn the warp's wild attention and anchored it there. Reality split. It sheared open like a fruit torn in two by hungry hands, shreds of pulp and pith stringing across the breach. It cut like a silk curtain. It opened like a mouth, like a wound. Light welled like unstaunched blood. The skin of reality sliced open along a jagged diagonal scar, torn by the tip of a ritual athame wielded on the far side. The blade cut peeled back corporeal reality on either side like excised flesh. A foul breeze exhaled into the scriptorium, billowing loose leaves further into the air until the chamber was a blizzard of fluttering pages. A figure stepped through the slice. He was huge and armoured in full plate, in his fist glowing and dripping with immaterial etherplasm, was the ritual athame. A second figure stepped through after the first, sword raised. Like the first, he was clad in the dark red and ritually inscribed armour of the 17th Legion Word-Bearers. Like the first, he wore no helm, for no helm could ever contain the twisted horns and scalp spikes that adorned their skulls. Their eyes were slits the colour of hot night. They were once proud warriors of the Legiones Astartes, who had willingly allowed demon things to spawn and grow inside them parasitically. They were unburdened. Their names had become Ulcas Tul and Barbos Ka, dull, inhuman echoes of the names they had been baptized with. They were members of the Dark Apostle Erebus' retinue, and had learned their evil craft directly from him. They were vile things, their plate covered with scraps of parchment, all of which bore the insane scriptures of a now mad creature who had once been the most insanely loyal of the Emperor's sons, Lorgar. A third figure stepped through behind them. He was a word-bearer too, but he was helmed, and his armour was grey, scraped back to the metal, and bore no inscription other than the Legion's crest. The warrior's plate resembled the colour of the scheme worn before the war, before the fall. The third warrior lacked the never-born traits that invested his companions. A massive Legion-issue sniper rifle was slung in a case over his back. He carried his bolt pistol, drawn and ready, in his hand. He was not ready, however. He shuddered as he stepped through the reality slice, and then dropped to his knees with a crash, shaking the wooden floor of the scriptorium. Pages swirled around him, covered with words. Some had started to singe and burn. With his free hand, Barthuza Narek took off his helm. Beneath it, his eyes were masked by a tied blindfold. He had insisted on that. He had seen nothing of the crossing, but he had felt it well enough. It was not a sensation that he ever wished to repeat. He had no idea how his brothers had ever embraced it, except for the fact that they were insane. He began to pull off his blindfold, but the trauma he had experienced finally swept him away. He pitched forward onto his hands and threw up. Stinking black bile squirted out of his mouth and plastered the floorboards between his hands. Burning scads of paper fell around him like snow as he heaved, prostrate and humiliated. With a shudder, the slice in the world behind him sealed again, and the sickly light faded. The swirling, burning papers began to cease their turmoil and scatter back on the floor as the wind died.
"This is the place, Narek," said Barbos Kaar, the Neverborn blessed with the Athame.
Kaar wiped the blade clean on his tongue and kissed it.
"As close as we can get." "Macragge?"
asked Narek, still on his hands and knees, spitting out toxic bile to clear his throat. He shuddered and gagged again. More bile jetted out of his anguished, gaping mouth.
"Macragge," agreed the horned thing with the knife. "Sanctuary city of our sworn foe. As the divination said, this is the place."
I thank you for your trouble, brothers," said Narek, trying to steady himself and rise. "I could not have reached this place otherwise."
"Then do what you must, Narek," hissed Ulkas Tul, the other horned thing. "Whatever your great mission is, whatever your hunt, it will be your last."
"I know,"
said Narek. Slowly, trembling, he got to his feet. His gut felt hollow. There was a disgusting taste on his palate. He held his bolt pistol in trembling hands that were splashed with flecks of tar-black vomit.
"You are pathetic," announced Barbos Kaar, turning away.
Kaar's bat tongue flicked the air, tasting it like an insect. There was a particularly unpleasant growth of hair and tumour on the back of his powerful, corded neck, where it rose above the gorget seal of his armour.
"We could kill here," he purred to Ulkas Tul.
Ulkas Tul smiled back. It was not a smile anything human ever wanted to look at.
"No,"
Narek said, spitting to clean out his mouth.
"No, you should go. You got me here, and I'm thankful for it. But coming here is suicide. To enter the fortress city of our enemies..."
"We are aware of the dangers," Barbos Kaar said.
He began to play with the Athame.
"But we can cut our way out any time we like, unlike you, Narek. Now we're here, we can have sport."
"May Lorgar watch over you," Ulkas Tul told Narek. "Barbos Kaar is right. There is sport to be had here. We are in the belly of the beast. Kaar and I will do as we please. We will take many lives before we leave. Maybe Gilliman's."
"My brothers," Narek said, "if you go on a spree, you will ruin my mission. I need to disappear. I need to work and hunt. You will spoil this for me if you go killing."
Barbos Kaar kept toying with the Athame that had cut open the warp for them.
"Look at you, Narek," he said. "So impoverished. Our transit alone left you gasping and sick."
"You have mocked us, burdened one," Ulkas Tul said. "You have scorned our conjunction with the warp, refused to take it into yourself, yet you are quite happy to make use of our magic to get you here."
"You are right, brother," said Narek, nodding. "I have dishonoured you and the glory you serve. Forgive me."
"Not good enough," said Kaar.
There was something horribly insectile about the way his mouthparts moved independently.
"You used us to get here. You used my knife."
"You used my divination to find your target," Ulkas added.
"We only brought you because of where you wanted to go,"
Kaar gurgled, saliva welling out of his maw and dripping onto the floor.
"Magna Macragge Civitas, home of our enemies. We will kill now and then depart. That is the price we claim for your transfer."
"Yes, I dishonoured you," Narek said. "I am not worthy of the magic you wield, but you must go now. Now."
"Is he threatening us?" Ulkas asked Kaar.
No, not at all," Narek told the demonic twins.
The smell of them was quite awful. Flies were humming around them, flies born out of nothing. Narek turned his head aside, spat out another fat gob of black phlegm, and looked back at his travelling companions. He tried to smile a reassuring smile at what remained of two men who had once been his sworn comrades. It had taken every ounce of his guile to persuade the pair to assist him at Traoris Starport, and every scrap of his stamina to tolerate their presence ever since. His weakness was not false, for the warp transit had harrowed him, but he was overplaying it to keep them pliant.
"Then you presume to give us orders?" asked Ulkas.
"I presume only the word," said Narek. He paused and wiped his mouth with the palm of his left hand.
"I believe in the word of our Primarch," Narek continued simply, "and I believe that word makes us loyal to the Emperor. We are of the word, and thus we are of the Emperor. It was ever thus. I despise the steps my legion kin have taken to embrace the outer dark. Too many steps, too far. You, Kaa, and you, Ulkas, you have polluted yourselves and our legion. Yet I thank you for bringing me here. You have done a great service to the loyal 17th.
They both glared at him, confused.
"What are you saying, Narek?" Kaa asked.
"I'm saying receive my thanks," Narek replied, and put four bolts from his pistol through Barbas Kaa's skull. Fragments of horn, bloody meat and brain tissue spattered out in an explosive burst that was driven from within by an eerie flicker of fracturing warp light. Barbas Kaa toppled backwards. Narek was fast, but not as fast as he had been in his glory days, thanks to the augmenting bionics that had repaired his leg. Ulkas Tul came at him, howling, swinging his blade. The light of dead stars blazed in his lidless eyes, and his lips had peeled back to reveal a screaming maw filled with serrated, blackened tusks. Narek tried to shoot, but the blade ripped the pistol out of his hand. Too slow. The cross-strike came back, and the sword scratched a deep gouge in his ceramite chestplate, almost splitting him entirely, as surely as Kaa's athame had split time and space. Narek smashed the blade aside with his forearm and backed away. Ulkas would not be denied. The unburdened swung again, another potential kill strike. Narek threw himself backwards, ducked further slashing cuts that would have severed his armoured torso cleanly, and then bypassed Ulkas's guard and landed a ferocious punch in the beast's snout. Teeth broke. Bits of them went flying. The unburdened monster lurched backwards, crashing into two script lecterns and shattering them. Still toppling, he caught himself against a heavy shelf to stop his fall, but Narek was not going to let up. Ulkas's guard was down, his sword flailing. Narek came in and delivered two more punches into the side of Ulkas's skull with his gauntleted fist, crushing his ear, cracking his brain pan. Raging, Ulkas smashed back at Narek, catching him a glancing blow that removed the two smallest fingers of Narek's left hand with the edge of his sword. Narek rolled away from the pain and the jetting blood and delivered a huge, angry, power-amplified punch with his right fist, which sent Ulkas flying the length of the scriptorium chamber. He hit the far wall, demolishing shelves, crushing books. Another blizzard of pages filled the air. Ulkas fell on his hands and knees, found his blood-stained sword, and got up again. He saw Narek across the chamber and came at him, charging, his sword drawn back for a two-handed strike. Narek had already dropped the case from his rifle and pulled it to his cheek, aiming. He felt the kill notches against his skin. He had time for one shot. He had preloaded a specialist bolt round for penetration and range, a custom-built core and propellant shell manufactured by his company armourer. Overkill at this distance. Narek didn't care. He enjoyed the explosive red murk Ulkas's head produced as it burst off his neck. Ulkas kept coming. Narek remained calm. Time had almost frozen for him. A sniper's greatest strength was steadiness and patience, even when the world around him was moving at high velocity. The sniper rifles of the legions were all massive weapons, and Narek's gun, the infamous Brontus pattern, was a particularly huge and unwieldy brute. It was long and heavy and cumbersome, and gauged for bolt rounds, an almost impossible trade-off between muzzle velocity and round impact. The bolt shells had to be tailor-made to compensate for range with an added propellant stage. The Brontos had an automatic bolt return, a fixed-sequenced powered cycle that chambered each round from the short-packed magazine. It also had a manual racking handle for faster returns. Narek calmly racked the bolt handle and fired again as the headless thing bore down on him. The first shot had been overkill, but the second... Ulcus's torso disintegrated in a crimson blitz of meat, sheared electrofiber bundles and armor shards. His ruined body collapsed at Narek's feet. Narek rose out of his firing crouch and lowered the smoking bolt rifle from his shoulder. His transhuman biology had already stopped the blood flow leaking from the stumps of his missing fingers. Something twitched nearby. Carr's corpse was still quivering. Narek slotted back the bolt of his rifle and put a final shot through Carr's chest into the floor. Carr's corpse jolted like someone slammed by cardiac paddles as the round went clean through him. Silence. Paper crackled as it burned and settled. The chamber reeked of toxic blood. Narek shook himself.
"Wake up," he muttered. "This is done, but there is so much still to do."
The enemy would be closing in, without a doubt. He had to move and lose himself. The Ultramarines wouldn't take him. He wouldn't allow it, not this early, not like this. He had work to do, the holiest work that any legionary had ever undertaken. He had to deliver his legion from evil. Narek bagged his rifle and exited the scriptorium. Outside, in a dank insulae, he cowered, hearing land speeders approaching and gun teams deploying. He took out the piece of parchment that Ulcus had given him before their departure and looked at the words written upon it. Grammaticus. The divined location of Grammaticus. Narek closed his eyes and let his mind dwell on his target. John Grammaticus, human, perpetual, and pawn of the Xenos breeds. He and John had played regicide against one another on Traoris. This new playing board, this Magna Macrag Civitas, would see the endgame. Narek of the Word fled into the darkening streets.